Cato and the Republic that consumed its own principles. Marcus Porcius Cato has survived history remarkably well, standing before modern observers much as his ancient admirers intended. Austere, incorruptible, and stubbornly devoted to a dying Roman Republic. In an era remembered for systemic bribery, political opportunism, and naked personal ambition, Cato appears reassuringly simple. Where many of his contemporaries adjusted their convictions to changing political circumstances or traded loyalty for power, Cato preferred death to compromise. Much of this formidable reputation was genuinely deserved. The difficulty arises, however, when personal virtue is mistaken for political wisdom. A man can be entirely honest, yet politically disastrous. He may possess immense courage while exercising flawed judgment, defending admirable principles in ways that ultimately damage the very institutions he wishes to preserve. Cato deserves to be evaluated from this perspective. His devotion to the Republic was neither a front for secret corruption nor mere theatrical posturing. His long career suggests that he genuinely believed in the moral and constitutional principles attached to his name. This makes his legacy far more difficult and far more interesting to examine. We must ask what happens to a republic when its strongest defenders begin to regard political compromise as moral failure. More seriously still, what happens when those same defenders become willing to suspend constitutional principles because they believe that only by doing so can the state itself be saved? The making of Cato. Born in 95 BC, Cato inherited a name that already functioned as a moral symbol. His famous ancestor, Cato the Elder, had become an archetype of traditional Roman severity, hostile to luxury, defensive of ancestral customs, and rigidly disciplined. To bear the name Marcus Porcius Cato was therefore to inherit more than ancestry. It meant inheriting a profound cultural expectation, one that the younger Cato appears consciously to have embraced. Our most complete surviving biography comes from Plutarch, though it requires careful reading. Writing long after Cato's death, when the historical man had already become a moral symbol, Plutarch frequently allows the character of the adult statesman to appear in stories about the child. He portrays the young Cato as stubborn, unwilling blindly to obey commands, and tells the famous story that during Sulla's dictatorship, the boy demanded a sword with which to kill the tyrant. Such perfectly constructed anecdotes are impossible to verify. Fortunately, we do not need them to recognize the adult Cato's genuine austerity. He actively cultivated physical hardship, immersed himself in Stoic philosophy, and acquired a reputation for severe moral seriousness while still comparatively young. Crucially, that reputation is supported by a contemporary witness who knew him personally and politically, Cicero. Cicero's Cato. While frequently frustrated by Cato's political obstinacy, Cicero respected his integrity. In 63 BC, Cicero defended Lucius Licinius Murena against charges of electoral bribery in a prosecution in which Cato played a prominent role. Because Rome was simultaneously descending into the Catilinarian crisis, Cicero believed that removing a consul elect at such a moment could further destabilize the state. His defense of Murena therefore became something larger than an argument about one defendant. It became an argument about the place of moral absolutes in political life. Cicero attacked the rigidity he associated with Cato's Stoicism. Human affairs, he argued in substance, required adaptability, mercy, and a willingness to reconsider one's position when circumstances changed. He would also complain privately that Cato sometimes behaved as though he lived in Plato's ideal republic, rather than among the actual citizens of Romulus. Cato understood clearly what he believed the republic ought to be. Whether he sufficiently understood what it had become is a more difficult question. The Rome Cato inherited was vastly different from that of his famous ancestor. Spectacular wealth from foreign conquest had flooded Italy, making political campaigns increasingly expensive and turning provincial commands into opportunities for personal enrichment and military glory. Decades before Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon, political violence had already entered Roman public life. The murders of the Gracchi, the use of Roman armies in domestic political conflict, Sulla's march on Rome, and finally, the proscriptions, had taught Romans a lethal habit. Extraordinary crises could be invoked to justify extraordinary departures from established restraint. Cato's insistence upon constitutional principle can partly be understood as a reaction to this decay. Yet one pivotal moment in 63 BC forces us to ask how absolute his own principles really were. It concerns the fate of five prisoners.
Five prisoners. The Catilinarian conspiracy confronted Rome with a genuine emergency. This should not be minimized simply because the episode later became politically useful to Cicero. Catiline had left Rome and joined an armed force. Evidence obtained through the Allobroges implicated leading conspirators who remained in the city. Several key plotters were arrested. The Senate met on December 5th to debate their fate. Among the participants were three men who would become central to the final history of the Republic: Cicero, Caesar, and Cato. Caesar argued against immediate execution. Cato argued for it. The Senate ultimately chose death, and Cicero, acting as consul, carried out the decision. In evaluating this moment, we must avoid oversimplification. Cato did not single-handedly persuade an otherwise merciful Senate to kill the prisoners. Cicero's later recollections indicate that support for severe punishment was already substantial. Nor were these innocent citizens selected for political convenience. The evidence of conspiracy was serious, and Rome faced an armed threat. Cato, therefore, had a powerful case. The state was in immediate danger. Associates of the conspirators remained active. Delay carried risks. To Cato, a government incapable of defending itself against men plotting its destruction might soon possess no constitution left to protect. Yet Caesar's objection deserves equal attention. As recorded by Sallust, Caesar warned not merely against cruelty, but against the dangerous weight of precedent. Extraordinary powers exercised against obviously guilty men could later pass into less scrupulous hands. What appeared justified today, because the intended victims seemed deserving, might tomorrow provide the precedent by which others justified oppression. This remains one of the great constitutional dilemmas of history. And in 63 BC, it created an extraordinary reversal of the roles later history would assign these two men. Caesar, the future dictator, argued for restraint, while Cato, the future martyr of republican principle, argued from necessity. The prisoners were Roman citizens and were executed without an ordinary judicial trial. The constitutional legitimacy of the action remained controversial, and Cicero would later pay heavily for his role when Clodius used legislation concerning the execution of citizens without trial against him and forced him into exile.
Romans themselves, therefore, recognized the problem. It is not an objection invented by modern historians. Who decides the exception? Cato could answer that an existential emergency had rendered ordinary procedures inadequate, and that hesitation might cost the Republic its survival. That argument cannot simply be dismissed. But once it is accepted, a more troubling question emerges. Who decides when an emergency is grave enough to justify suspending ordinary constitutional restraints? In 63 BC, Cato trusted the Senate to make that judgment and urged it toward the severest conclusion. Given the circumstances, that may have seemed entirely reasonable. But political principles do not remain the exclusive property of those who first employ them. Once accepted, they become available to others. The late Republic increasingly became a political world in which rival groups claimed that their particular crisis justified conduct that would otherwise have been unacceptable. This is where Cato's decision reaches beyond Catiline. It does not make him personally responsible for the later collapse of the Republic, but it places him inside the mechanism of constitutional deterioration, rather than safely outside it. The Republic was not being weakened only by its obvious enemies. It was also being weakened whenever men convinced of their own righteousness concluded that ordinary restraints could not be permitted to obstruct the salvation of the state. A Republic knows how to deal with a criminal through established law. The deeper decay begins when respectable statesmen conclude that legality itself is no longer sufficient. The politics of the good man. There is a persistent temptation to divide the late Republic into a neat moral arrangement of good and bad actors. Catiline fits conveniently among the villains, Cato among the virtuous. Caesar causes difficulty precisely because he refuses to remain comfortably within either category. Political systems, however, rarely collapse according to such tidy moral divisions. A corrupt man may damage institutions for personal enrichment. A virtuous man may damage them because he believes the stakes are too high to permit compromise. The latter can be particularly dangerous, because his conscience reassures him. Cato possessed extraordinary confidence in his own moral judgment. This does not mean that he regarded himself as infallible, nor that every refusal to compromise was an error.
A healthy political system requires individuals capable of saying no. Compromise is not inherently virtuous, and may, under some circumstances, amount to little more than surrender. The difficulty lies in knowing when to stand firm and when to yield. Cato's career repeatedly illustrates this tension. His opposition to Pompey contributed to the obstruction of Pompey's eastern settlements and provision for his veterans. His hostility towards Caesar was rooted in legitimate fear of exceptional commands and the accumulation of personal power. Yet his resistance also contributed to the circumstances in which Pompey, Caesar, and Crassus discovered that cooperation outside the senatorial establishment could achieve what ordinary senatorial politics would not. The so-called First Triumvirate was not a constitutional office. It was an informal political compact operating outside the formal constitutional structure. Cato did not create the political conditions that made such an arrangement possible, but absolute obstruction was not their solution. Here, Cicero's old criticism returns. A statesman must distinguish between an ideal conception of what ought to happen and what can realistically be achieved without producing something worse. Cato's tragedy may have been that making such a distinction sometimes looked too much like surrendering principle. The strange flexibility of inflexibility. This brings us to a profound paradox. Cato is traditionally criticized for stubborn inflexibility, yet that description may be incomplete. In 63 BC, he proved remarkably flexible concerning ordinary constitutional protections when he believed the survival of the state required exceptional action. His inflexibility, therefore, did not always apply to constitutional procedure itself. It applied more consistently to his judgment of what the Republic required. If Cato believed that a crisis justified extraordinary measures, he could support them. When opponents claimed that extraordinary circumstances justified exceptional measures of their own, he could condemn them as assaults upon liberty. The critical question is whether the distinction always rested upon an objective constitutional principle, or whether it sometimes depended upon Cato's confidence that his cause genuinely represented the Republic. We must be cautious. The circumstances surrounding Catiline, Pompey, Caesar, and the later civil war were different. Treating every extraordinary action as equivalent would rob history of precisely the distinctions we are attempting to understand. Yet the broader pattern deserves attention. By the final decades of the Republic, political actors increasingly ceased to agree about where legitimate authority ended and illegitimate tyranny began. Once that shared understanding disappeared, constitutional politics became extraordinarily difficult to sustain. Plato's warning and the meaning of libertas. Centuries before Cato, Plato had analyzed how political systems might destroy themselves. Rome did not follow the constitutional sequence described in the Republic, and it would be crude to pretend that Plato was somehow predicting Roman history rather than examining the political world of the Greek city-state. Yet one of his insights travels remarkably well across the centuries. Political systems can be destroyed not merely through the abandonment of their defining values, but when those values become excessive and detached from restraint. Freedom provides Plato's most famous example. A democracy may become so devoted to unrestricted freedom that authority itself becomes intolerable. Restraint is interpreted as oppression, hierarchy becomes suspect, and eventually, the desire for unlimited liberty produces disorder. From that disorder comes the demand for the strong ruler who restores order by destroying liberty altogether. Whether one accepts Plato's wider political philosophy or not, the paradox is powerful. A virtue can consume itself. Something structurally similar appeared during the final decades of the Roman Republic. Libertas became one of the most powerful and increasingly contested concepts in Roman political life. But what exactly did it mean? The liberty of the Roman people? The legal protections of individual citizens? The liberty of magistrates to exercise lawful office? The freedom of senators to govern without domination by an overmighty colleague? Or the independence of the Republic from a single master? These meanings could overlap, but they could also conflict. A Roman statesman could therefore violate one citizen's protections while sincerely claiming to defend libertas itself. It is precisely at this point, when the shared meaning of political principles begins to fragment, that political language becomes dangerous. From Cato to Brutus. Cato died at Utica in 46 BC, and therefore could not have participated in the assassination of Julius Caesar 2 years later. But his presence on the Ides of March should not be dismissed merely because he was dead. Cato was Brutus's maternal uncle. Brutus admired him deeply and eventually married Cato's daughter, Portia. Following Cato's suicide, his memory rapidly entered the ideological struggle surrounding Caesar's victory. Brutus wrote in his praise. Cicero produced his own Cato. Caesar felt sufficiently challenged by the emerging legend to respond with his anti-Cato. Cato had ceased to be merely a dead politician. He had become an argument. We cannot draw a simple line of causation and claim that Cato taught Brutus to kill Caesar. The evidence does not permit it. But Cato's legacy allows us to ask a more interesting question. Did the Republican tradition, represented by Cato, help create an intellectual world in which extraordinary action could be understood as a moral duty when the Republic itself appeared endangered? The comparison between 63 and 44 BC cannot simply be ignored. In 63, Roman citizens accused of conspiracy were held in state custody. The Senate debated their fate. Caesar argued against execution, Cato argued for it, and Cicero implemented the decision. In 44, there was no comparable proceeding. Brutus, Cassius, and their fellow conspirators did not bring Caesar before a court, ask the Senate to condemn him, or establish his guilt through a constitutional procedure and then execute a sentence. They decided for themselves that Caesar represented an intolerable danger to the Republic, and they killed him. The difference is enormous. Cato could at least argue that in 63, the constituted authorities of the state had acted during an active, armed emergency. Brutus and Cassius effectively constituted themselves as the authority capable of deciding that Caesar must die. Yet, behind these profoundly different circumstances lies a related constitutional question. When the Republic is believed to be in mortal danger, who has the right to decide that ordinary restraints no longer apply? The conspirators of 44 BC answered that question for themselves. In doing so, they demonstrated how far the Republic had travelled. The Republic consumes its principles. This may be the most disturbing aspect of the Republic's decline. Its destruction cannot be explained simply as the work of bad men attacking a good system. Again and again, prominent Romans departed from traditional restraints while claiming to defend Rome. The aristocrats who killed Tiberius Gracchus believed they were protecting the state from a dangerous political threat. Sulla invoked political necessity when he marched his army on Rome. Cicero and Cato believed that the execution of the Catilinarian conspirators protected the Republic. Caesar would later argue that his enemies had violated his rights and those of the tribunes and had left him without an acceptable political alternative. Finally, Brutus and Cassius presented Caesar's assassination as liberation. The circumstances, motives, and legal arguments were very different, and they should remain different. Yet, across the political spectrum, leading Romans increasingly claimed the right to identify exceptional dangers and to justify exceptional measures in response. Once that habit becomes established, law gradually ceases to function as a common restraint. One faction invokes constitutional principle against another, while reserving the right to depart from it when necessity demands. Its opponents do the same. Each insists that its own exception is different, and each may even be sincere.
By its final years, the Republic still possessed laws, magistracies, assemblies, and a Senate. What it increasingly lacked was a shared conviction that all sides must remain bound by those institutions, even when the immediate result was one they found intolerable. That represents a form of constitutional decay far deeper than financial corruption. The danger of virtue at Utica. This returns us inevitably to Cato himself. Perhaps history has been asking the wrong question about him. Was he a hypocrite? Probably not in the conventional sense. Was his austerity theatrical? To some extent, perhaps. Roman politics was inherently public, and Cato understood the political force of his reputation. But public display does not prove insincerity. A man may genuinely believe in the virtues he consciously represents. There is little reason to doubt Cato's courage, his remarkable incorruptibility by the standards of Roman political life, or the sincerity of his devotion to the Republic. Indeed, these qualities are precisely what make his political failures worth examining. If Cato were merely another corrupt aristocrat, hiding ambition behind noble rhetoric, he would be historically unremarkable. His importance lies in the more troubling possibility that he meant it. He genuinely believed that Rome required moral regeneration. He genuinely feared the accumulation of extraordinary personal power. He genuinely believed that constitutional government required men willing to resist convenience, intimidation, and corruption. He was right about all three. Yet genuine virtue does not guarantee sound political judgment. A republic certainly needs men who refuse to sell their principles. But it also needs leaders capable of distinguishing principle from pride. It requires resistance, but it also requires accommodation. It requires constitutional rules, but above all, it requires citizens willing to remain within those rules when the immediate result is not the one they desire. That may have been the quality the late Republic was losing. Not honesty or courage, but restraint. Cato's final act made his reputation immortal. Following Caesar's victory at Thapsus, Cato found himself at Utica. Caesar was approaching, and Cato could have chosen to live. Instead, he chose suicide. For later generations of republicans, the symbolic meaning was unmistakable. Cato would not receive his life as an act of Caesar's clementia. To accept pardon was, from Cato's perspective, to acknowledge Caesar's right to determine whether another Roman citizen should live. Cato refused the premise. It was an extraordinarily powerful act. Yet even here, the boundary between moral grandeur and political usefulness remains difficult to determine. Cato's death preserved his personal independence, denied Caesar the opportunity to pardon him, created a martyr whom Caesar could defeat but could never reconcile, and transformed an often troublesome and obstructionist politician into an enduring symbol of republican liberty.
but it did not save the Republic. One might even ask whether a living Cato, participating in the imperfect political world that followed the Civil War, could have done more for Republican government than the dead martyr. Perhaps not. Caesar's dominance after Thapsus was overwhelming. But the choice remains entirely characteristic of Cato's life. When confronted by a choice between compromised participation and uncompromised refusal, Cato chose refusal. At Utica, he chose it absolutely. His personal victory was complete. His political cause was lost.
The last virtue.
The historical Cato is therefore neither a marble saint nor a cynical hypocrite. He is something considerably more interesting and perhaps more disturbing. He demonstrates that political systems are not endangered only by people who despise their principles. They may also be endangered by people who love those principles so intensely that they become incapable of recognizing the compromises necessary to preserve them. But Cato's story suggests something deeper still. The Roman Republic did not collapse simply because Romans ceased to believe in it. It collapsed while Romans were fighting and eventually killing one another in its name. That distinction matters. Catiline could be condemned as an enemy of the state. Caesar could be condemned as an aspiring tyrant. But the constitutional problem becomes much more serious when those who sincerely believe themselves defenders of the Republic begin to decide that exceptional circumstances permit exceptional actions. Who then determines when necessity is genuine? Who decides which constitutional restraint may temporarily be ignored? And what prevents the next Roman, confronted by a different crisis, from making exactly the same argument? The debate of 63 BC gives these questions an almost tragic resonance. Caesar warned against the precedent created when extraordinary punishment was accepted because the immediate victims appeared to deserve it. 19 years later, Caesar himself lay dead after a group of senators concluded that an extraordinary danger required an extraordinary remedy. Cato did not kill Caesar, nor should he be made intellectually responsible for a decision taken after his death by men acting upon motives of their own. But Cato belonged to the political culture from which that decision emerged, and Brutus belonged personally and intellectually to Cato's world. That connection should neither be exaggerated nor concealed. Perhaps this is also where Plato's warning acquires its greatest force. Political systems do not necessarily perish because their virtues disappear. Sometimes a virtue is pursued until it ceases to serve the purpose for which it existed. Liberty without restraint can destroy liberty. Principle without judgment can damage the institution's principle was intended to protect. Virtue without political imagination can become sterile. And a republic whose defenders repeatedly permit themselves to depart from its restraints in order to save it may eventually discover that there is very little republic left to save. This is why Cato remains such an important figure. He recognized that a republic without virtue could not survive. He understood that political freedom required restraint upon personal power, and that corruption could hollow out institutions long before those institutions formally disappeared. Yet,
he may not have recognized with equal clarity that virtue alone was insufficient. A functioning republic also required political judgment, the ability to distinguish compromise from surrender, adaptation from corruption, and political defeat from existential catastrophe. Above all, it required something extraordinarily difficult: the willingness to accept that constitutional restraints must bind one's own side as firmly as they bind one's opponents. By Cato's lifetime, that willingness was disappearing throughout Roman politics. Cato was certainly not responsible for creating the disease, but neither can we comfortably place him outside it. And therein lies the final irony of the man later generations chose as the embodiment of republican virtue. Cato may have represented precisely the virtue the republic desperately needed, and, in its most uncompromising form, one of the reasons virtue alone was no longer enough to save it.